When one sets out to offer a few thoughts by way of retreat or a parish mission, you have to begin somewhere, and there are many places to begin. And where I chose to begin is by trying to invite you to ponder a question that I proffered during the course of the weekend Eucharist. What goes on inside of you when you hear the word God? It seems like such a simple question at first, but I would suggest it's a little bit more involved than at first gloss. What are the images that you conjure up? Is it the image of the judge? Is it unconditional love? To get a little bit of a handle on these images, these attitudes, these underlying things that give rise to the way we perceive God, allow me to tell you a story. And the story revolves around, of all things, my mother's chocolate chip cookies. Now, I was introduced to these little miracles of chocolate 72 years ago when I was around 5 years of age. I was in the kitchen when out of the stove came this cookie sheet. I said, "Mom, what are those?" She said, "Jim, those are chocolate chip cookies. You will learn to love them." And my mother never lied to me. So I said, "Well, can I have one?" She said, "I'd love to give you one. But if I give you one, then your sisters are going to want one. And besides, it's close to dinner time." So my five-year-old brain computed dessert. Certainly this extraordinarily kind lady's going to give them to us for dessert, but it got worse. It seemed she needed them for a gathering of her women friends the next day. So no chocolate chip cookies from this very kind lady, even for dessert, but with a craving that perdures these 72 years later. I awakened around midnight wanting a chocolate chip cookie. I snuck down the stairs, and I knew there was a God that night because the stairs that usually creak did not creak to awaken my parents. Around the corner I went and into this absolutely pitch-black kitchen. I deftly moved the chair over to the counter, got up on the chair, took the lid off the cookie jar, had my grubby little five-year-old paw in the cookie jar at midnight in the pitch-black kitchen, when out of the darkness came this voice that said, "Jim, this is God." Now, I invite the church to put yourself in that kitchen at age 5. What do you hear God saying to you? I'll tell you what I heard God saying to me. "Jim, you're being a bad boy. Jim, get out of this kitchen. Jim, get back to bed where you belong." Well, that was somewhat the view I had of God at that age. But let's tell the story a second time. You're 5 years old. You snuck down the stairs, your hands in the cookie jar. It's pitch black. It's midnight. When out of the darkness comes this voice that says, "Jim, this is God. Take two cookies." Then everything changes. But what's changed? Notice, God has not changed. It's just my image of God that's changed. But see, that makes all the difference in the world. I was in Idaho a few years ago, helping with a retreat. Stayed at the home of a family, which was delightful. The fly in the ointment, however, was their little 4 or 5-year-old guy had a pet cat that was killed by an automobile the day before I got there. This child was inconsolable. Many of you have been down this road. And the parents tried this, and the parents tried this, and finally they played their trump card when they said, "Johnny, that's okay. Your cat is in heaven with God." To which Johnny said in my presence, "Mom, Dad, what does God want with a dead cat?" Now, that story, like all good stories, led to still another story that the mother of that child related that night as we were wafting over the events of the day. She said, "You know, about a month ago, my girlfriend down the block, her little girl almost fell down the stairs, but I caught her. And I said, 'Susie, aren't you glad God loves you? God didn't let you fall down the stairs.' And Susie said, 'Mom, I'm glad God loves me. Doesn't God love Johnny? He fell down the stairs last week.'" So we can give very, very simplistic answers to very, very profound questions. So what I'm inviting the church to ponder a little tonight is what goes on inside of you when you hear the word God. And most of the images we have are formed early on. People who study this much more carefully than we might study it, people with names like Jim Fowler and Eric Erickson and Milton Rokitch, they will say things like this. You want to know what love, God, sex, faith is all about? Put yourself back in your parents' home around the age of 5, 6, 7, 8. And ask your parents, "Mom, Dad, what's love, God, sex, faith? What's that all about?" Whatever you hear is pretty much what you believe today. But then they will go on to say, in their estimation, the greatest discovery in the recent centuries that we've made is that we can change both the way we feel and the way we behave by changing the underpinning attitude, images, attitude that give rise to the way we feel and behave. Why is that important? It's important because of a little letter that Paul wrote to the church at Philippi, to the Philippians, when he said, let your attitude, your predisposed way of seeing reality, the word attitude in Latin is optus, you're apt to do something. Let your attitude be that of Jesus. And if we can make his attitude our attitude, what will happen? Fifth chapter of Matthew, oh, you'll be the light of the world. You'll be the salt of the earth. That's why this is important. So when we begin to look at these early on images, it's like a little seed being planted. And if it grows in a healthy environment, a loving environment, a faithful environment, fine. But sometimes they get a little twisted along the way in which we need a course correction, so to speak. So allow me to tell you what my images of God were growing up. For no other reason than maybe it'll stimulate something inside you. It might be the same thing as me, as I am, or you might think I'm speaking Chinese up here. It matters little. And this is going to be done all too quickly. But let's at least give it a shot. When I was growing up, first of all, God was very, very masculine. We always referred to God as he or him, never she or her. But God cannot be categorized by time or space, and certainly not by gender. God is God, but my God was very masculine. Those of you who are a little older will remember Pope John Paul I, the smiling pope that reigned for 33 days. He said something interesting in that short time. He said, we call God Father, and fittingly enough, but even more so, in his opinion, can we call God Mother. So if you want to say our Mother who art in heaven, be John Paul I's guest. But my God was very, very masculine. Secondly, my God was very distant. My God was out there somewhere. And it seemed the purpose of prayer was to keep hammering away at this sometimes somewhat reluctant God to give me something I thought I needed, wanted, or possibly deserved. Thirdly, my God seemed to be somewhat angry at me. And my task in life was to keep God minimally happy so that when I died, I'd at least get a toenail into purgatory, because somehow from purgatory you made it to heaven. Now, at age 7 or so, I didn't understand that, but sister said, and sister was usually correct. Finally, my God was very judgmental. I mean, I'm being judged every day of my life and usually falling rather short of God's expectation. The way I pictured it was God seated in a chair of judgment in a hall of justice with a scowl on his face. And strung between heaven and me is this tightrope, and I'm walking this tightrope trying to get to heaven. But God's swinging this pendulum across it because God knew by the time I was 7 or 8, I'd belted my two sisters more than once. I wasn't worthy of the joys of heaven. I figured at that young age, the odds of my getting to heaven, about 50-1. And that was on a pretty good day. Now, you know, you say, well, that's kid stuff. Is it? Look at the little seed that's being planted in little Jimmy's heart. And all of a sudden, it's going to start to grow. So I began to ask myself, well, where did these images come from? I just didn't wake up at the age of 7 or 8 and say, well, guess today's God Day, Jim. You figure out who God is for the rest of your life. No. It came from a whole crazy quilt of happenstances, catechesis, incidents, stories, all generated by extraordinarily good people. We are not speaking about rogues and scoundrels. We're speaking about my parents and the Sisters of Mercy who educated and catechized me and to whom and for whom I am eternally grateful. Do I wish a few things could have been tweaked a little differently? Yeah, I do. But hopefully in 50 years they're going to be saying the same thing about this night. He said what? He should have said it this way. Why do you use that word? So hopefully we do what they did. In other words, play the best hand with the cards we have dealt to us. So I began to look at some of these significant moments that formed these images, these attitudes early on in my life. I began to look at First Eucharist. We call it First Holy Communion in those days. And as they were describing the Eucharist to us, did they describe it as the gathering of the God's people to celebrate and proclaim who we are? No, they did not. But I remember three things. And this is 70 years ago. Three things. The first one, now, if you're older than 7, it looks like most of us are. Well, maybe you aren't. Get inside a 7-year-old's. Otherwise, this may smack of irreverence, and I have neither the desire nor the right to do that. Get inside the heart of a 7-year-old. The first thing I remember was this. Do not bite the host. Do not bite the host. I'm 7 years old. You've told me, take this and eat it, and now I can't chew it. How does that work? But more important than that was point number 2. As they were preparing us to receive First Communion, Sister would act in the classroom like the priest with a container of altar breads, hosts, unconsecrated. We'd light up down the aisle. We'd go up, stick out our tongue. Sister would place the host on my tongue. We'd go back to our places. But I noticed at that young age that the unconsecrated altar bread was sticking to the roof of my mouth. Now I figured out, boy genius that I was, that if the unconsecrated altar bread is going to stick to the roof of my mouth, the consecrated host is going to stick to the roof of my mouth because I will have fasted from midnight. Midnight. But this index finger, under the pain of mortal sin. Think about that. Think about that. Is not to touch the host, to release it from the roof of your mouth. Because if it does, and you die, you are going to hell for all eternity. That's what they told little Jimmy. That also meant I wasn't going to see my parents anymore. Didn't care too much about my 2 sisters at that time. But my parents mattered. Think about that a little bit. All of a sudden, another little seed's being planted in little Jimmy's heart of what God is like. Well, how do you avoid the mortal sin? How do you avoid touching it? How do you get it removed from the roof? Sister had an answer for that. Sister had an answer for everything. She said, boys and girls, this actually happened. Boys and girls, 1, 2, 3. And we practiced then. And I avoided a mortal sin. Furthermore, I avoided going to hell for all eternity. But think what was being told us by extraordinarily good people. But more important than that was point number 3. You are not to swallow the toothpaste or take a drink of water after midnight and then knowingly go up and receive Holy Communion. Because if you do, not only is it a mortal sin, now they're talking sacrilege. Which meant to my 7-year-old brain that they're going to bank up the flames of hell to receive my sin-laden First Communion soul. Well, here we are, First Holy Communion Day, 1944, 45. St. Mary the Lake Church, north side of Chicago. There is no way on God's green earth that little Jimmy can get a drink of water. Mom and Dad had tied the faucets. We put pillows in the sink in the bathtub. We got the school. There was an 8th grader in front of every water faucet. But somehow, despite those precautions, little Jimmy got a drink of water. What does a little Jimmy do? Because if I go up and receive communion and die, I'm going to hell for all eternity. Furthermore, I'm going to get burned for the rest of my life. But how could I not go up and receive communion? My relatives have come in from Des Moines, Iowa, in the Rock Island, had my little white suit. Mom had a cake in the icebox, and it was an icebox. She put the ice in from the porch side. And Sister's back there with her clicker. Well, I went up and I received my first Holy Communion. And all the way home from St. Mary the Lake Church, everybody's happy for little Jimmy. But little Jimmy's heart's going pity-pat, pity-pat, pity-pat. Why? Because I have to cross Sheridan Road. And if I get hit by a truck crossing Sheridan Road, I'm going to hell for all eternity. And they're going home and have a party on my first communion day. Now I know it's patent leather shoe stuff. I know it's just plain silly. But there's another little seed being planted in little Jimmy's heart. And if that isn't challenged or changed, and you say, oh, that's just kid stuff. Oh yeah, is it? I've run into too many people. We're still dealing with this type of thing. I then began to look at first reconciliation. We call it confession, but remember, confession is one part of the sacrament of reconciliation. One part. Very important, because until I look my demons in the face, I will dance with them. But it's not the most important part. The most important part is we leave that celebration having experienced and tasted exactly what Pope Francis is talking about, the mercy, the compassion, and the love and forgiveness of our gracious God. That's what's most important. So I began to look at this, and I remember that my playmates and I, would go to confession every Saturday. Every Saturday during Lent, we went as a family. So every Saturday, maybe 7 or 8 of us went over. to St. Mary of the Lake Church. And we went there age 7. In fact, we began to do that before we had completed the sacraments of initiation, baptism, confirmation, Eucharist. So we went there every Saturday, age 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. Somewhere around 12, as best I can remember, it was no longer the guy thing to do. Girls kept going, guys didn't. But we did go over to the church to get something churchy, like an old bulletin or a holy card, to prove to our parents we'd been to the church. But we didn't go to confession, age 12, 13, 14. Somewhere around 14, that's the beginning of what we call the negative stage of adolescence, 14 to 19. That's when your home becomes like O'Hare Airport. Kids land, get refueled with food and sleep, and off they go. And as they go, you say, where are you going? Nowhere. What are you going to do? Nothing. With whom? Nobody. You ask them to write a poem many times. This is all too quickly done. If they write a poem many times about fall and winter, not spring and summer, the glass tends to be half empty, not half full. You start to hear them say, I don't give a damn, you can go to hell. You think they're going crazy. No, no, no. This is the negative stage of adolescence. In other words, they have 1 foot in childhood, 1 foot in adulthood, and they're neither place. So where you go, nowhere? Exactly right. Who doesn't understand whom? Hell and damnation are things of nothingness. Somewhere around 1920, again, this is too quickly done, they're going to ask their parents for a broom. Well, what do you want a broom for? Well, I'm going to clean my room. Well, this room has not been cleaned for 6 years. But now they're into another stage called early adulthood. But when you're in this negative stage of adolescence, one of the things that descends upon us, and it descends upon everybody here, but many times we were too embarrassed to talk about it, or if there wasn't a healthy environment at home, people were seldom would voice this. That is the whole sexual awakening. And all of a sudden, I'm thinking and feeling and doing things I never felt done or did before, and every one of them was a mortal sin. Every one of them. There's no such thing as a small sexual sin, either mortal sin or nothing. Well, at that age, that's all I'm thinking, feeling, doing. Well, what's my task in life? I've got to get to heaven. What's my ticket to heaven? Back to confession, which I'd quit going to about 3 years beforehand. By this time, we got evicted. The 12 flat we lived on the third floor in the back. That building was sold. The new landlord didn't like kids. Anybody with kids had to move. So we moved 30 miles south of Chicago to a fledgling suburb called Park Forest. This is 1949-50, designed for the returning war vets. When we moved there, there were 800 people, no streets, no sidewalk. We had 3 stores. We had a grocery store, a drug store, and a liquor store. Sort of the essentials of life. We had a movie theater called the Holiday Theater, in which we celebrated Sunday Eucharist. This is a sidebar. You could always tell the Catholics when they went to a movie because they tended to genuflect before they went into their chair. Well, there were 2 priests there, Father Coogan, Father Boyd, and my parents, being the gracious people they were, would invite them over for Sunday dinner maybe once a month, once every 5 weeks. Now, get this picture. Get inside this. I'm 15, 16 years old, this sexually sin-laden adolescent kid. I'm directly seated opposite these 2 priests. Can you, in your wildest imaginings, think I'm going to go to confession to those 2 guys? That is not going to happen. So on Saturday afternoon, I get on my bicycle and I pedal down 26th Street, 1.5 miles, to the neighboring suburb called Chicago Heights, where I have my choice of 3 churches, St. Anne's, St. Agnes, St. Rocco. Now, as I'm pedaling down, you got to get inside this kid. As I'm pedaling down 26th Street, what am I hoping for? 2 things. Lord, please, please do not let me get hit by a truck going. Because if I get hit by a truck going, it's hell, but coming home at 7. But at that young age, almost more important to me was this. Lord, please, please let it be the Polish priest who can't understand English. And then I can get in the confessional, mumble whatever it was I said. He'd say a Hail Mary, I'd get on my bicycle, pedal home, saying to myself, Lord, maybe let me make it to Wednesday or Thursday. Then I get to do it all over again. Now, I know it's patent leather shoe stuff. I know it's just plain silly. But if that remains unexamined, there's another little seed being planted. in little Jimmy's adolescent heart. So this is what Tillich, one of our marvelous theologians, meant when he said, one of the greatest heresies in our church is that God created us in God's image and we return the favor. That if this is the way I love and forgive, that must be the way God loves and forgives. And then you live out of that awareness. But nobody has ever loved us like God has. Again, Francis trying to teach us this. Nobody has ever forgiven us the way God forgives us, which we'll talk about more tomorrow. So into all of this mishmash that each one of us deals with in one way or another, let's invite Jesus Christ. Now here's the question. Here's the question. Now we have to be careful about this question, otherwise we're going to wind up in left field. The question is simply this: when did Jesus Christ know that he was divine? Not is Jesus divine, that was dealt with at the Council of Nicaea in 325. We say the Nicene Creed usually during Lent. That's not the question. That was settled there. Jesus is fully human, fully divine. That's not what we're talking about. What we're asking is, when did Jesus know that? Church has never pronounced on that. So you can believe pretty much what you want to believe. You want to believe he was about 6 months old, woke up in his crib one day and said, whoop, guess I'm God. It sounds silly, but you can believe that. And some people do believe that. From the moment of his conception, he knew it. It sort of flies in the face that he grew in age and grace and wisdom before God and the people. But you are certainly welcome to believe that. Some people like to believe it was the age of discernment, 7 or 8, somewhere in there. Most people, I find, like to believe it was at the time of in the temple at age 12. I have to be about my father's business. Does that really prove it? Or does that show his fascination with his Jewish heritage and tradition? Jesus was a Jew of the first commandment all the way through his life. I can remember, maybe you did this, 99 days out of 100, we play the seasonal sport, my playmates and I. But every rare once in a while, maybe twice a summer, we play Mass with Necco wafers. Do you ever do that? Mass with Necco wafers? Because somehow when we went to Eucharist with our family on Sunday, we were fascinated by what went on. We didn't quite understand it, but there was an aura of mystery and wonder and awe. And we tried in our little way to emulate that. So, believe what you want to. I, for one, want to believe it might have been around the age of 30. See, we know nothing about Jesus for 18 years, from the temple incident to the time of his baptism by his cousin. What do we call it? We call it the hidden life. What's hidden? What's hidden is who he is. Then at age 30, John the Baptist, we think, some think, that he belonged to a group called the Essenes, a rather rigorous group that believed in the water baptism for the forgiveness of sins. But Jesus shows up at his cousin's baptismal pool, is baptized by John, and then the Spirit appears and says, "You are my beloved son." Jesus now knows to the depth of his being that he is the beloved of God. Then what is he? Then he is led by the Spirit. This is not Jesus saying, "I think I'll go to the desert and reflect on it." No, no, no. This is all Spirit driven. He is then led by the Spirit into the desert to be tempted to deny what he just found out. If you are the Son of God, well, he knows that. He found that out at John's water. Throw yourself down. Take over these kingdoms. Turn this stone into bread. Power, possession, security. Who among us isn't tempted to that? Heard anything about 401ks recently? How about Social Security? I was in, I think it was Tennessee, 2 years ago, I guess it is now. We were following this car and it had a bumper sticker, but we couldn't read it. So you're hoping for a red light so the car stops and you can read it. So we got the car stopped and the bumper sticker simply said, "Be good to your kids because they're going to choose your nursing home." Power, possession, security. Who among us? So he overcomes the temptations, thus deepening within himself the reality of who he is to do what? To return to Capernaum, to his hometown synagogue, where he takes out the prophet, the scroll of the prophet Isaiah. You remember this. And there it says it again. "You are my beloved son, and you my favorite rest. You are to restore sight to the blind, set prisoners free, declare a year of liberty for God's people." He rolls up the scroll, hands it back to the assistant and says, "Today, now, this is fulfilled. I am with you." Then what does he do? He does exactly what you and I are called to do by baptism. He goes out to confront evil. And the first miracle there is the cure of the demoniac. In other words, Jesus enables the demoniac to see in himself what Jesus came to see in himself, that he is the beloved of God. The second miracle is sort of cute. I mean, that's the wrong word. It's sort of interesting. It's the cure of Peter's mother-in-law. Now, this is another sidebar. The curmudgeons ask an interesting question. They say, why did Jesus cure Peter's mother-in-law? And they say, well, you know how Peter was getting feisty with Jesus and ultimately will deny him and all that business? One day, they say, Jesus had it up to here. He calls Peter over and says, Peter, if you keep this stuff up, I'm going to cure your mother-in-law. Well, maybe yes, but probably no. But notice the rhythm in his life. He comes to the awareness of that he is the beloved of God. Then he goes out and enables others to see in themselves what Jesus came to see in himself. And those others told others, and those others told others, and those others told us. And what behooves us is to tell others. But we can only tell others if we are aware of it. Not just in our noodle. We know this stuff. I'm not telling you anything you don't know. But in the very depth of our being. That we are the beloved of God. That God's very presence lives within us. The kingdom of God is among you. God's presence lives within us. Blessed are all, and on he goes. Trying to get it from here into here. That we are the beloved of God. What if we could believe that? What if we saw in others what we see in ourselves? Changes everything. There's a little Buddhist story that, see what you think. It's a story about a Buddhist monk who comes to know this army colonel. And for whatever reason, the colonel can't tolerate the monk. And one day in a fit of rage, he looks at the monk and says, you know when I see you, do you know what I see? I see a pig. Well, the monk was nonplussed. Didn't seem to bother him one iota. In fact, in a very genteel and kindly fashion, he said, and colonel, when I see you, do you know what I see? I see our beloved Buddha. Well, that was like salt in the wounds, was it not? And even more enraged, the colonel says, how can you say that? I just called you the worst thing anybody could call one of you people, a pig. Yet you call me your beloved Buddha. How do you do that? And the monk simply said, well, you see in others what you see in yourself. Pretty true. This is what our Jewish sisters and brothers mean when they say, you do not see others as they are. No, no, no. You see others as you are. But what if we could see again, not just in our noodle, but in the depth of our being, that we are the beloved of God. So we come to Eucharist Sunday after Sunday to do what? To deepen within us around word and table the reality of who we are. You'll notice 5 minutes after we receive communion, we are out of here because the work has been done. What behooves us is to go out and see in others what we see in our... But gather again next week, because this is like trying to nail Jell-O to the wall. This is slippery stuff. Some days it just seems so clear, doesn't it? But there are other days when we sort of wonder about it all. The word liturgy in Greek, liturgia, has nothing to do with anything religious or spiritual. It simply means work, secretarial pool, ditch diggers. So we come here to do some work around word and table, to deepen that reality. And then when the last word now says, now go, that does not mean I hope you're the first one out of the parking lot. It means go, more aware of your blessedness, but gather again next week. Slippery stuff this. Try it this week. Go to the grocery store. I don't know what they're like here, but buy 7 or 8 items. No more, 7 or 8 items. And go to the 10 and under line. Well, now where I live, same here probably, 15 and under, right? So anyway, go to the 10 and under line. You're standing there with your 7 or 8 items in the 10 and under line when all of a sudden you start counting. And in that basket ahead of you, there are 16 items. And she's in the 10 and under line. Now, what are you going to see in that person? Just a selfish person? Well, maybe. But maybe you're going to see somebody who didn't even notice the sign saying 10 and under. Or maybe you're going to see somebody who did indeed notice the sign but is standing there saying to herself, oh, I don't want to be here. But I've got to get home to a fevered child. I'm suggesting you're going to see in that person what we see in ourselves. But again, what if we could see that we are the beloved of God? So it's just removing whatever it is that does not allow us to see what never left us in the first place. Tomorrow when we gather, we're going to reflect on reconciliation. And those who wish to, this is not an expectation, obviously, but if you wish to celebrate the fullness of the sacrament, we will do so during the course of the evening. And I think there will be four priest confessors, if you so wish. But think of these attitudes that were imaged. How did you celebrate reconciliation as a kid, as a teenager? What does it mean? Do you enter that box with fear and trepidation or with anticipation of being able to let go of whatever that's something you've been holding on to? It's just letting go. Letting go. That's all it is. It's the awareness we are more than who we think we are. And the more than who we think we are is the very presence of God lives within us. But the selfishness, the envy, the pride, the lust, whatever it is, muddies the water. There's a marvelous mystic, 13th century mystic by the name of Meister Eckhart, and he would ask the question, is the sun shining on a cloudy day? Well, if you asked me that, I'd look at you as if you had two heads. I say, no, the sun is not shining on a cloudy day, but it is shining. Just remove the obstacle of the clouds. It's right there. Hasn't left. John of the Cross, he will say, deep inside the human person, there is a wine cellar of the choicest wines. But because we're not even aware the wine cellar is there, we settle for ordinary tasting water. But the wine cellar's there. It's there. All we have to do is remove whatever it is that doesn't allow us to see it. In a story usually attributed to Michelangelo, they asked him, these stories get attributed to all sorts of people. But they asked Michelangelo, how did you sculpt David? How did you do that? And his answer, so attributed, was something like this. Oh, I just took a huge chunk of marble, and I just chipped away everything that wasn't David. David was in the marble. The authentic person each one of us is deep inside. All we have to do is keep chipping away, and ultimately we find him. And so we will celebrate reconciliation tomorrow. Not in the sense of something to keep me out of hell, but to remove whatever it is that doesn't allow me to see what never left me in the first place. And more aware of that presence of the beloved within me, I can then go forth and do the only thing he asks. Now see in others what you more deeply see in yourself. And in giving life to them, they will live. And for Jesus, because the only thing you ever keep for Jesus is what you give away, you will live as well. It's a genius. Absolute genius. And so we gather tonight just to reflect. And when we hear the word God, what goes through? And so we've got all sorts of baggage and things like that inside of us. That's why the genius in the church for having people like what we call spiritual directors or somebody to walk with a spiritual friend. I just ask you the question, not to embarrass anybody, not to embarrass a single soul, but in this past month, have you ever sat down for 20 minutes with somebody and said, when you pray, what are you doing? Who really is Jesus Christ in your life? It's not that we're bad people, but we have this Lone Ranger approach to God. It's God and I. We say our Father, but we sort of mean my Father. But just imagine if you had a small faith community or as a family, we began to ask the questions that need to be asked to put some things in perspective. Let me conclude then with this. I think you'd probably call this poetic prose. People who study English closer than I might know better. But I hinted at this during the course of the weekend Eucharist. Where shall we hide the Spirit of God from people? The gods all cried when they were made. How can we guard our secret now? They asked each other so afraid. Hide our spirit in the earth, they will mine it. Hide it on a mountain, they will climb it. Even in the sea, they will find it. Where, oh where, shall we hide the Spirit of God from people? Quite beside themselves, they cried, these people will take our throne. We've made them far too smart not to claim our heaven home. Hide our spirit in the wind, they'll pursue it. Hide it in an atom, they will view it. Even in an act, they will do it. Where, oh where, shall we hide the Spirit of God from people? They thought of stars in outer space or in the nature of a tree, but they knew. The people could solve each and every mystery. Hide our spirit in matter, they'll analyze it. Hide it in water, they'll crystallize it. Even in hell, they will surmise it. Where, oh where, shall we hide the Spirit of God from people? And then they solved the puzzle of how the frightened God should win. The wisest said, let us take the Spirit of God and hide it deep inside of them. Hide our spirit in their heart, they will doubt it. Hide our spirit in their very soul, they will live without it. Even if we reveal it and shout it, they will never, never believe. that the Spirit of God is deep inside of them.